Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the University of Sussex Business School. Welcome to episode 55, where we are discussing Kurt Lewin's 1947 article, Frontiers in Group Dynamics, Concept, Method, and Reality in Social Science, Social Equilibria, and Social Change, published in Human Relations. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This is Tom, calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
Hi, this is Ralph, coming to you from the high desert of Albuquerque, New Mexico, also in the United States.
Hi, this is Michael, coming to you from Utrecht by Night in the Netherlands.
Hello, this is Steve calling from Wellington in New Zealand.
Welcome, everybody.
Thanks, Tom.
Hi, great to be here.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, I wanted to mention to our listeners that joining us is one of our newest cast members today, Michael. I'd like to ask you to go ahead and introduce yourself really briefly.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. I'm Michael, an assistant professor at Utrecht University's School of Governance, which is the Department of Public Administration and Organizational Science. My research focuses very much on public-private interactions with a specific interest in civil society organizations. Currently finishing a project, for instance, on public-private partnerships in social infrastructure development. And at the School of Governance, I'm responsible for the master's program on organizational change and management.
Welcome to the cast, and we look forward to hearing you not only today, but in future episodes.
Yeah, very much so. Looking forward to it.
Okay. Now, we'd also like to bring to attention our special guest, Stephen Cummings, who's coming to us from Wellington, New Zealand. Stephen, why don't you introduce yourself really briefly, please?
Sure. Thanks, Tom. So my name is Stephen Cummings, and I've been fortunate enough to have been involved in some of these great podcasts before. I'm a professor of strategy and organization here at Victoria Business School at Victoria University in Wellington, New Zealand. And last year, with a group of colleagues, Todd Bridgman, Michael Rowlandson, and John Hazard, we wrote a book called A New History of Management, where we looked at a range of historical figures in management studies and looked at the way in which their ideas had been simplified or changed to create this narrative. And the book really seeks to undo or to unpick some of those assumptions and look a little bit more deeply at the legacy of these great works, and importantly, how this new understanding could help us think differently about management today and in the future. And I'm particularly excited about today's podcast because the person whose work we're going to talk about is Kurt Lewin. And Kurt Lewin is, I think, a key character in the history of management. And many of his ideas have been well understood, but many of his ideas, I think, perhaps not so much. So it's a great opportunity for us to talk here today about Kurt Lewin's work.
Okay, thank you. And speaking of which, the work that we're addressing is going to be Frontiers in Group Dynamics, Concept, Method, and Reality in Social Science, Social Equilibria, and Social Change, which was from 1947, published in one of the first issues of Human Relations. Steve, why don't you go ahead and give us an introduction to the text?
This paper is actually the first ever paper published in the journal Human Relations. It's volume one, issue one, paper one. And the background to it is really interesting and also a little bit mysterious. This was published in 1947. It was a paper published in two parts. I think we're going to focus mostly on the first part today. The second part appeared in a subsequent issue. And in between, Kurt Lewin dies suddenly. And so there's a lot of interesting speculation about how the article was created, or the two articles, Frontiers in Group Dynamics 1 and Frontiers in Group Dynamics 2, how these articles were created and what sort of process went on in terms of editing, you know, referees being involved, what Kurt Levine's intentions were. Did he have a chance to completely review these articles? And again, in that sort of personal context of Kurt Levine being very much alive at the start of the process and having tragically passed away at the very young age of 56 before the second part of the article came out. Now, to give it some broader context, Frontiers and Group Dynamics is a really hopeful and positive and optimistic piece of work. This is being written just at the end of World War II, and there's a real hope, particularly in Levine's mind, but also in the minds of those at the Tavistock Institute, which is where Human Relations Journal is based and is developed from in London in the United Kingdom. There's a real hope that after World War II, there's an opportunity to change the world for good, to apply the latest thinking in social psychology, group dynamics, these new social sciences which are emerging around this time, to apply these things to try and avoid many of the problems that had beset the world across the past decade, or actually all the way back, I suppose, to the turn of the 20th century. And Kurt Levine is seen by the people at Tavistock as the flag bearer for this new way of thinking about how people behave in groups, how people behave in relation to particular environments. So this article is really seen to be the start of a new world, a new world where we can treat social sciences in the same kind of ways that we've treated the normal or the natural sciences, to really try and help humanity advance. And so Levine starts off with this very, very hopeful message and begins to unpack some of the key ideas that he has been working on for many decades. And it's really a rallying call, a call for the journal and a call for social psychology and group dynamics to help the world develop in a better way. And a better way than it has developed in recent history for Kurt Levine and the others in the Tavistock group.
Yeah, you can kind of see it in the early pages where he tackles the challenge of comparing social science with other sciences and the problems of trying to understand, you know, well, the words that he uses are existence, in terms of the you know, how do you describe the existence of something or something in a social context as an empirical science? Because at the time it was a very natural or a very significant divide between what was being studied empirically versus what Levine was trying to trying to draw attention to.
Yeah, and I think one of the things I really appreciate from this piece is that some of the things that we might take for granted now, and Steve was talking about that, about the book he's written and this work's place in the history of management science, I think it's really easy for people today to say, well, this is all obvious. I mean, this is what we do. And what's really nice is the way Levine breaks that down, helps us takes us through a time when that was not so obvious, and it was not necessarily clear to everybody that you could use similar kinds of techniques to describe group dynamics. So I found that part of the article really helpful.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I know, for example, when I talk to students today about Levine's work, you know, you're absolutely right. It seems obvious. I mean, you know, his equation, if you like, and I think he's very conscious, and the people around him are very conscious to try and create a social psychology, you know, as a social science, which is reflective of the normal or the natural sciences. So he creates this equation, you know, behavior is a function of personality and the environment. And today that just seems obvious, right? We think, well, of course, you know, the way we behave is a function of who we are and the environments in which we find ourselves. But at the time that Levine was writing, this wasn't so obvious. You know, he's trying to bring together two opposing schools of thought. One is this idea that we behave according to our, you know, our natural telos or our drive, this idea of a great man or a great person acting as they want. And then, you know, a structuralist view, which suggests that, well, we're, our behavior is determined by the environment. And Levine, by combining, you know, what we call, you know, psychology with what we call sociology, tries to bring these two things together. And this, this little equation that behavior is a function of personality on the one hand, but just as equally environments on the other hand, it's a radical view, and it's a really important and interesting view. And like a lot of views that seem obvious now, they're obvious because somebody had to actually do the work to develop them.
I think the interesting thing is that the comparison also to the natural sciences, which is indeed moving, I think, the social sciences towards the frontier. So the title or the text really reflects the title in a way. So being an article just after the Second World War and using a metaphor like frontiers, I think it's also very much an agenda for a positive development of the social sciences. And I think he really struck some notes for developments that are still going on today in organization studies.
Yeah, it's almost kind of like he's also trying to knock the natural sciences off the pedestal. The whole section about the reality of social phenomena, which was section 3, and he's talking about how the sort of like the relationship between the natural sciences and the social sciences at the time, where the social sciences were clearly being viewed as either lower form of science or not science. And you know, Levine is really trying to elevate the social science to something, you know, to something that is equivalent and equally rigorous. And in a lot of ways, you know, what he does in throughout the course of the article, which we'll get into specific examples, is just, you know, trying to put that into tangible terms, such as, you know, when he's the early example of the husband and the wife, how they are interacting and moving in a social space in ways that are very, you know, very tangible. But when I read the example that he gave, I was able to picture, you know, how I interact with my spouse. His ability to try to bring these social phenomena into something that is tangible to the same level as how the natural sciences treat them is very interesting and very enlightening, especially given the time.
Yeah, I thought that was a brilliant maneuver on his part, because as I'm reading through it, I had the same reaction you did, Tom, that I could visualize some of these things. But it wasn't just that. I mean, it was a nice concrete example. But then you could think your way through these actions that are going on and the reactions. And I think it really helps him demonstrate the tangible nature of the phenomenon or phenomena he's attempted to address a little bit more generally later in the essay. So I just love the way that that's constructed right up at the front, so that you can see, yeah, he's really talking about practical things. And I know we'll talk about it later, but he talks about like the man of action, person who has no need for theory. And then he starts explaining, well, why perhaps you do, and why that might shed some insight. So that, and I think that goes along the lines of what Steve was talking about earlier, this hopeful nature that we could actually help humankind or management organizations advance. So I thought that was very productive.
Just to pick up on that, I think that he does have this great skill that a lot of people who make advances in science in a way that appeals to everyday people, he has this ability to blend theoretical development with practical examples that we can all relate to, you know, whether it's the story of the husband and the wife, or whether it is the story of the mother seeking to, you know, feed her family in a nutritious way. He writes in such a way that he brings you into the example, but in a way of advancing, you know, theoretical or scientific theories as well. And I really think that that's a skill, and it's one of the reasons that that Levine has become so popular.
Why don't we dive into the, since we brought it up, why don't we dive into the husband and wife example a little bit more? It's depicted graphically in page 11, but I think what it's kind of telling a story of is you picture the husband and the wife as being in different places within a social environment. And what it's showing is sort of like a, I don't want to say a dance. Maybe it's kind of like a dance, but it's sort of like an action reaction. And the husband, from his perspective, is thinking about, you know, he's going to move in a social context in a particular direction, which might represent words or actions that his wife would perceive. And the husband has an expectation of how the wife would respond. Like if the husband is waving hello or saying something sweet, would expect the wife to respond in kind, perhaps. And this is being represented by the wife moving equally in the social space. And then he's showing what happens when the wife acts differently, which is to say, moving in a different direction, or it's metaphorically moving in a different direction than what the husband expects. And so you go back and forth and you see how people who, from each other's perspective, has got an expectation of what would happen next, only to find that they're confounded by the partner's different response. It's a very interesting way of depicting how misunderstandings and differences of perspective can different effects or different outcomes than what is expected.
Right. And I like the idea that this is diagrammable. Just from the point of view, it brings home to you that they're really in different places, right? And just as well as mentally, the physicality of the diagrams helps bring that out, so that not only do you have these misperceptions that Tom is talking about, but they're not even in the same place you think they are, as far as, you know, how you might be appealing to them, or some action you might take, or how it's how they receive it, because they're in a different location. And I just think that's a profound insight that really opens up because of the diagram.
I think that's absolutely true, and it's a radical way of depicting human behavior at this point in time. You know, Lewin really is trying to make the social sciences, you know, really trying to put them on the same level as the natural sciences. And his use of these diagrams, I think, is a great illustration of that. He wants these sciences to be taken seriously. So he's really thinking about, how can I convey these ideas in a way that people can relate to, but also in a way that makes them look and seem scientific. And, you know, today when we create a diagram, it's not that difficult, right? You know, you play around on a package on your computer, and you move some lines around and then you print it out, or you look at it and if it's not quite right, you can adjust things a little bit, cut and paste, so on and so forth. But these diagrams are all drawn by hand. There's meticulous and painstaking work that has really gone in to this, and it reflects you know, an academic, a scholar who is really thinking hard about, you know, I want my ideas to be understood. So what can I do to help people understand them? And this combination of the graphical presentation and the very relatable example, I think, really helps us get into to Levine's ideas.
So, Steve, I have a question for you about you talk about this groundbreaking work. And one of the things I thought was amazing, and I thought maybe you'd have a better perspective on this than I would, is this idea where not only does he talk about these steps here, but he also talks about the variables that you use to look at social equilibria and understanding phenomenon. And that to me seemed pretty radical, because we're talking 1947. And once again, today we don't think very much about saying, okay, here's what the intervening variables are and here's what we think was going on. And yet he's kind of trying to make this concrete through this mathematical analogy that maybe was very, very revolutionary or groundbreaking for its time. And I was just wondering if, based on your studies, that's the way you see it, or I'm off on that.
No, absolutely. And I think this is why the people at the Tavistock Institute in the United Kingdom were very excited about the idea of working with Levine. because he really was taking the social sciences in a new direction. As you know, as was said earlier, the social sciences were really the poor cousins up until this point. You know, the idea that serious academics would study these things, you know, it seems commonplace today, but it wasn't then. And actually, you know, on the one hand, his examples now seem very relatable for us. But in his own time, you know, it's important to remember that the research that Levine was doing was on quite domestic examples. So, you know, mothers feeding their families, husbands and wives interacting. You know, a lot of the work that research, or the research that was being done, was in these domestic or social settings. And that was because there weren't opportunities to do research like we do today in organizations, in business companies, because nobody in business companies and organizations would have valued this research. They wouldn't have seen it as being important. In a strange way, you know, when we look at it today, we really enjoy the relatable examples that, you know, of domestic life that we can all, you know, we've all experienced. But, you know, this is Levine really trying to work from the ground up. The opportunities he has to do research are on domestic settings. So he's taking those domestic settings really, really seriously and looking really, really deeply at them to present them in quite a radical and revolutionary way. And, of course, the people at the Tavistock Institute and people all around the world who wanted to see management and organization studies as, you know, more valid forms of inquiry, you know, they see Levine as a flag bearer. And as we can talk about perhaps later, you know, one of the mysteries and the tragedies is that just as this is starting to gain momentum, Levine passes away. So it's often interesting to speculate, well, he was only really just getting started. I mean, I know he'd been working for a number of decades, but at 56, you're kind of in your prime, right, as a scholar, as an academic. So it's very groundbreaking, and it does lead to advances in our field. But it's really interesting to speculate. Where was Levine going to go from here?
Well, I think the interesting thing is that the diagram is it's on domestic relations, on domestic settings, but it offers, of course, a very helpful way of comparative analysis. So often studies are quite context specific. He uses a context specific example, but through the diagrams, he's able to uplift the analysis towards much more general fields, and I think that's very I think that's one of the powers of the article. If you look at the diagrams, I was actually kind of surprised by the diagrams, being this my first time to read the article. And it really struck my attention, seeing these relations, human relations, in these diagrams, and not only for one example, but continuously showing his analysis in a figurative sense, and I think that's really appealing in the for the article.
Now, one of the constructs that he uses frequently through the article is this one of force fields, and this is where, you know, once he gets past the initial husband and wife scenario, he shows, or basically depicts, a whole series of situations using the metaphor of a force field and gradients of a force field, which is representing forces that are stronger and forces that are weaker. And he also gets into driving and restraining forces and others. What is your take about what he was trying to do with this construct of force fields?
Well, I mean, I think, having said all these great things about Levine, I think he's really pushing the metaphor, if you like, of physics as kind of a model of the sciences. And in some ways, I think subsequent work we've maybe scaled back those kind of metaphors, if you like, you know, force fields, quasi-statics, stationary equilibrium, force field.
Phase spaces, you know, those kind of things.
Exactly. And so, again, I think that's why it's important to understand this article in context. Levine and the people at Human Relations, Tavistock, they're really keen to show that this is a proper science, the way that people understand what a proper science should be. And so actually some of these terms now are a little bit jarring for us, because if we hear human relations being talked in these very sort of, I suppose, physics-type metaphors and analogies, it seems to dehumanize them. But he's really sort of trying to push the envelope in terms of saying, well, look, just as we can understand atoms, we can understand humans as being subject to these different forces. And so I think while we maybe don't use these metaphors so much anymore, he really is opening people's eyes to the fact that all of the advances that have been made in the physical sciences could be useful for thinking about how human beings act and react individually in environments and when they come together in groups. And I think, again, this probably needs to be seen in the context of the times, and I think Michael made a good point that while the examples are very, I suppose, commonplace or domestic, they're speaking about bigger things. And of course, very much at the forefront of every scholar's mind or every individual's mind at this point in time is how did the Second World War happen? How did Nazism happen? I mean, how did people similar people in reasonably similar environments act in such a way that when we look back on it, it just seems abhorrent. How did this happen? How did they react to these different forces in such a way that led them to condone terrible atrocities? And so you can kind of see with, say, for example, the husband and wife, two similar people who really know each other find themselves in a situation where they respond to the cues, the forces for one kind of behavior and the forces for another, in quite different ways. And so I think those metaphors are really useful to understand anything from the relationship between a husband and wife in a social setting. And then, going macro, the reactions of the populations of different Western countries, who have reacted to challenging economic times in very, very different ways. So just to summarize, I think the sometimes the physics type terminologies are not successful in the sense that probably the envelope is really being pushed by Levine here to try and promote this idea that social sciences are just as valid as other sciences. But they certainly they get us thinking. So while I'm not sure that we would use some of these metaphors or analogies today, they really confront us and get us to think. And coming back to the diagrams, to imagine ourselves as being subject to these different forces, and how we react to them and achieve some kind of equilibrium in our lives, but at the same time change and adapt, particularly when we come together in groups and start to moderate our behavior.
Steve, a question. Did you, in your research, find evidence that, Levine is using these physical sciences or the metaphor of physics to position the social sciences, but did you find any relations or any evidence his work being mentioned in the physicals, in the physics?
Well, we didn't specifically look at that, but certainly I haven't seen it. And again, my guess is that the physical sciences carried on doing what they were doing. And I think at that point in time, there probably wasn't a lot of overlap going the other way. Subsequently, I think there has been. You think of behavioral economics, for example, which seeks to take some of these understandings of human behavior and how people react in relation to others and environments which might in ways which would lead them to not necessarily act as rational atoms, if you like, or rational actors. But at the time, I think Levine was really, I suppose, speaking to the general public. I don't think he was gaining a lot of traction within the natural sciences, but that wasn't his aim, I don't think.
But certainly, it seemed like his choices of what situations he was using and describing the application of force fields was interesting. Precisely, you know, going along with Steve, what you were saying about the about explaining what had happened prior to World War II, we see him using examples such as aggression and joining and membership in different types of groups, which are, you know, what he was breaking them into, democratic groups versus autocratic groups, as a way of understanding how people's perspective of where they fit, you know, their perspective of being a member of different groups, especially if they change from one group to another. That was very interesting to see how he was tracking people's attitudes changing in response to being members of one group or another socially. And then he carried a lot of the same kind of ideas to membership in work settings, where you move from one context to another, especially, say, if you were doing the same job while in one place. I think it was using somebody using a sewing machine, moving from one context to another, finding that, well, you know, okay, you're doing the exact same job with the exact same equipment, and yet the change in the social setting changes your perspective of membership in the group. You feel like you're going back to the beginning as like an entry-level member, when really we would have expected that you would just blend in and just do the same job and everything would be the same. So I think his choices of which situations he was describing using these force fields was very interesting and very telling with respect to, you know, what he was trying to get across.
Well, the other thing I thought was really interesting about that approach that he took, Tom, was that he started with equilibrium, right? Or quasi-stationary process, you know, those kinds of things, and then tried to ask the questions about, well, what causes the changes? That's a little like what Stephen was talking about earlier in these ideas of what some of the causal factors are or were of World War II and how people could, you know, do these kinds of things. And I think it was really interesting that just like the physical sciences often start with equilibrium and then what it takes to move off of equilibrium, he was looking at that and then trying to argue for more rigor from the point of view, hey, you need to look at the details of the phase space, the details of the context to understand where you are.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And so you can kind of see what Levine is doing here. He's using these physics type metaphors and applying them to social settings. You know, that to come back to Tom's point about why does he choose these examples, I think it's important to note that these examples, it's not so much that he's made a choice to go and look at people working in sewing jobs or clothing manufacture or domestic situations. These choices are not really choices. They're reflective of the work that he's doing. As I said earlier, it's not like today where you might get research sponsored by an organization or a government might want you to do research into productivity or things like that. You know, Levine was a professor of child psychology, and during his time at the University of Iowa, you know, the research was directing him to look at domestic situations, because this was a time where in America people were very interested in, well, how does a family live well? How does a family eat well? So these sort of, I suppose, social progressive views. So these were his research settings. It wasn't like he was choosing to focus on a largely female workforce and on domestic settings. That was the research that was available to him. But with that material, I think he does some really interesting things. You know, despite the fact that Levine now is seen as a great leader in change management, he probably only did research into what we would call sort of real commercial organizations very late on in his life, when organizations themselves became interested in funding that kind of research. So he's using the settings that he's researching, and because he's a good researcher, he takes these settings seriously. And I think by blending those domestic settings with this almost sort of physics approach to research, he does, you know, take us in some really interesting directions and things that we can relate to, both on a micro level in terms of our own behavior, but also I think in the background is this the theorizing he then goes on to do about democratic and autocratic environments and how we might react as individuals to one or another. And we might sort of feel that, well, we're democratic people, we're very good, we've learned these behaviors and it's become part of our personality. So if we're dropped into an autocratic environment, we will seek to change that autocratic environment. But as Levine is kind of indicating, it's not that easy, because there's a whole force field coming against you, which over time can make it very, very difficult for you to assert your personality, no matter how strong or good that personality might be.
Yeah, and speaking of personality, I think there's one instance where Levine talks about, going back to the sewing machine case, say a trainer, and if you have beginner sewers using a stitching machine, then where he shows that a very good, successful trainer is capable of getting the beginners to perform even better than what would ordinarily be expected. And yet, when the trainer leaves, then it seemed like the performance of the stitchers went back to what would have been expected. I thought that was interesting, because I know that I've seen that same sort of phenomenon happening in, like, I work in education. So when I see that, for example, you have a really, really good teacher who seems to get more out of students than what is expected, and then you take them out of the equation, like they're on vacation or they've go on to greener pastures elsewhere, and then an ordinary average quality educator comes in, then you end up with the results sort of reverting back to what is expected. And I'm not sure that I fully grasped how he was explaining. He was talking in terms of learning curves. If he was trying to explain that in terms of a sense of a equilibrium, or if that was just sort of like, there's this expectation, you can vary from it for a period of time, but then there's forces that will just simply return you back to the norm if a particular stimulus is removed.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting example, and it's one that is actually, very, I think, still interesting to us today, particularly for people who are educators. If you move further on in the article, he starts to build on the example that you mentioned, Tom, by looking at how, people's behavior can not only change, but that changed behavior can be, if you like, embedded so that you don't revert back, or that the group doesn't revert back to its previous behavior. And he reports on some really interesting experiments about a group of mothers who are encouraged to consume more fresh milk as opposed to substitutes, powdered milk, those sorts of things. And what he finds is that, the traditional methods of instructing people how to act in ways which are seen to be better, if you like, broadcast methods or of issuing information, or in this instance, giving people a lecture on the benefits of fresh milk, that has an initial positive reaction, but that falls away pretty quickly. However, what he finds is that people discuss the benefits of using fresh milk, for example, in a group, the group plays a role in ensuring that behavior changes to a greater extent, but also that change remains, that people don't revert back to using less healthy substitutes for milk. And I think anyone who's taught a class will realize at some point that, you can lecture a class all that you want, but unless you get smaller groups within that class interacting, talking about the material, sharing their own experiences, you don't get the full effect because it's that group dynamic. And this, you know, comes back to the title of the article. You know, Michael mentioned how important the idea of frontiers was, but also the second part of the title is group dynamics. And Lewin is really pushing this idea that, you know, if you want to see change happen and change to be embedded, then group behavior is really, really important. So that socialization process of where a group works together to find the benefits of a new way of doing things, that group dynamic then encourages changes to stay embedded so that individuals don't revert back. The group encourages the individuals within that group to respond in a way that embeds change.
And that sort of leads us to perhaps the one part of this article that really has withstood the test of time, and that's his conception of how you do lasting change or embed the change through the three-step process of unfreezing, moving, and refreezing, which I know that I've encountered, and it sort of manifests itself in other change management books who refer to Levine directly to say that, those were the three phases he described. We'll add steps to that or what have you. But it's still fundamentally the same idea of a deliberate effort to try to weaken what was the old practice, move to some new state, and then embed it, refreeze it permanently in the group.
Yeah, that's right. That it's interesting because that part of the article is the one that I'm not sure whether it stood the test of time, but it certainly was the one that was picked up on by management scholars in the 1960s and 70s as management, you know, beyond social psychology and social sciences, you know, management studies or organization studies becomes more a thing in those subsequent decades. And this idea, which is later, as you say, Tom, you know, added to and steps are created, the sort of the three-step notion of change, you know, unfreeze, move, and freeze, that gets sort of the terms get changed over time. It's really only a small example in the article, but, you know, maybe as we can talk about in the second part of the podcast, it has a lasting effect and it sort of takes on a life of its own. But I think what's really important with that is to see this context of group dynamics. And whereas management studies has really picked up on this sort of three-step, what's later referred to as a model, although Lewin really just refers to it in passing as a way of thinking, it's the importance of group dynamics. And again, it's one of those ideas that seems commonplace to us now. Well, you know, groups are important. But when Levine was doing his work, most people focused on, you know, if you like, the macro level of the organization or the government or the country and individuals. This idea of taking groups seriously as a unit of analysis is a new one. And that's why Levine is really pushing it, because his research is showing that, you know, if you want to change behavior, then don't try and change individuals. Don't try and change whole countries. Focus on groups, because groups are what sustain change. And as he says, you know, with the, you know, behavior as a function of personality, environment, is that different personalities can see the same environment in different ways. You know, coming back to the husband and wife example, you know, two people who know each other quite well can respond differently to different environments. But the thing that brings people together is when they start to act in groups and they share their experiences. So the example of mothers using fresh milk, and it seems like quite a banal example now, but, you know, it's a relatable example, and this was the research that Levine was being encouraged to do in his work. You know, it's when these groups come together, individual parents, and start to talk about their experiences of using different products to feed their family, something happens socially where that environment does become shared and people support each other in in a change process. So I think this is, while I think people have focused on the change is three steps, unfreeze, move, and freeze. Other people later called it refreezing. Levine never used that term. But I think the lasting message perhaps should be the importance of groups in education and in social behavior. The group is a key unit of analysis that has been overlooked and still to some extent today is overlooked in favor of focusing on individuals or organizations as a whole.
I think the three steps also relate back to the beginning of the podcast, the positive feeling with the article and the way of moving forward, having a lasting impact in a way. So he says it's not enough to try to reach a different level, but really have a change, really have permanency in a new level. And I think that's interesting in his analysis. That he really tries to develop social reality in a sense, and that's what he expresses as well with the three steps. To me, he really tries to achieve higher levels of group relations, I would say.
Well, definitely, I think we can probably talk at part two at length about the degree to which the change management literature that has followed, whether or not it has maintained the spirit of what Levine was talking about, or if it's deviated with it. Perhaps we can discuss that in part two.
And I think that's a great idea, Tom. I do want to follow up on something Stephen said that I thought was very insightful about the role of groups. There's a quote on page 34 when he's talking about individual procedures and group procedures of changing social conduct that I think sums it up very nicely. Last sentence before section six, he writes, if the group standard itself is changed, the resistance which is due to the relation between the individual and the group standard is eliminated. That's a really powerful conclusion.
It is, yeah. And I think, as Tom is saying, in part two, perhaps we can unpack the way in which these different ideas are picked up by later scholars.
And that concludes part one of episode 55. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or through our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Please join us next time as we continue our discussion of Lewin's classic work on organizational dynamics, here on Talking About Organizations.